everybody. Welcome back. Sorry we couldn't have a nice sunny day, but at least we have better weather than the South is having this morning with the tornadoes in Alabama and Georgia.
Oh, you get quiet so quickly.
Well, it must be rubbing off on our museum and archive and PBS colleagues. How many of us who work in libraries have been told by the patrons, could you please be quiet? We're trying to study in here. All right. Well, I'm very pleased this morning to welcome Mary Shute, the Deputy Director of Library Services from IMLS, who will be doing the morning introductions. Many of us are familiar with Mary. She has been with IMLS for almost 5 years, 6 years? Oh, April 1st. 5 years, April 1st. Mary has served as Deputy Director, and we were very pleased when we heard that she was appointed for a second four-year term. Mary came to IMLS from a position of State Librarian for the state of Delaware. So without further ado, I welcome Mary to the podium.
Thank you, Liz. And I'm the deputy for libraries, and I'd like to acknowledge, although I'm not positive they're here, both of my counterparts, the two other deputies at IMLS, have been here throughout both previous days of the conference and pre-conference. Marcia Semmel is our deputy for museum services, and Mamie Bittner has been at IMLS for a number of years, but has a new title of deputy for policy, planning, research, and communications. And if they're here, I hope they'll wave. If not, please look for them over the rest of the morning. Welcome, everybody. And the sun will come out a little later today. I promise you better weather. Nobody even laughed at my April Fool's Day hiring date. I'm still waiting to see who the joke is on. It is my distinct pleasure to be introducing this morning's keynote. I actually met Deanna for the first time in February of 2002, shortly before I took this position. I was sitting at the table wearing two hats, Delaware State Librarian and incoming deputy for libraries, when we had one of our first conversations around what shape the program that ultimately became the Laura Bush 21st Century Librarian Program would take. And Deanna was our expert facilitator, so it's a real pleasure to be here with her this morning. Her full bio is in your binder, and I'm not going to bore you with all the details. I'll just give you a couple of little lead-in sentences so you don't have to turn to the back and read quickly before she starts speaking. Deanna's career has been extensive. It encompasses having worked in the 90s at the Library of Congress as the Director of Public Service and Collection Management. Before that, she was the Dean at the School of Library and Information Science at Catholic University. When she left the Library of Congress, she was appointed President of the Council on Library Resources and President of the Commission on Preservation and Access. And she oversaw the merger of those two organizations into what we know as CLEAR, the Council on Library and Information Resources, where she served as president until August of 2003, when she was appointed back at the Library of Congress as Associate Librarian for Library Services, which encompasses a whole bunch of stuff, 53 divisions and offices, over 2,000, almost 2,500 employees, and she's responsible for all sorts of things that, as I said, are in the bio. The thing that stands out for me this morning as being why she's here and the perfect keynote is that she's also responsible for integrating the emerging digital resources of the library into the traditional artifactual library. So I'm anticipating she has a great perspective for us, and I would ask you to join me in welcoming Deanna.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary. I've realized, it's taken me a little while, I now realize that when people say, I've had an extensive career, it means I'm getting too old. So but I do appreciate very much the invitation to be here this morning. I'm going to have some slides on the screen, and I'll make these available to the conference planners, and they can distribute these to you along with the full text of the speech. In the midst of daily challenges of administration, having to deal with personnel problems, budget questions, service demands, systems glitches, and other headaches that are very familiar to all of you, I sometimes forget the most important thing. There was a time when librarians were happy if they could finance shelving and a wood stove. In a small town history, I recently read about an early day librarian who, quote, wrapped herself in a blanket with a soapstone at her feet during the coldest of Saturday afternoons, the only time the library was open. The thing I so easily forget is that in both libraries and museums, we've advanced so far, far beyond what an early librarian, even if she got warm, could possibly have imagined. Here we are today at this conference talking about something called the Internet, which through electronic magic can make material in our institutions, the text, pictures, maps, even films and sound recordings, quickly available to anyone, anywhere with a computer. We are working in the midst of the digital revolution. We are part of an enormously exciting time in the cultural history of humankind. So I want to forget my soapstone kinds of concerns this morning and take just a moment to express gratitude for the opportunities today that far outrun the accompanying challenges. I first want to offer appreciation to those who have sponsored this conference. I worry that we don't take adequate time to thank the people who plan these programs, who pay for these programs and make it possible for us to come together. OCLC, the J. Paul Getty Trust, and the Institute of Museum and Library Services are certainly in our debt. They've put together a very stimulating set of presentations, and it gives us an opportunity to reflect on many of the issues we're all trying to face and make some progress in, these digital era stewardship questions. I speak this morning under the title Digitization for Access and, notice the capital letters, Preservation. The thought that the two could be linked is important to me because we at the Library of Congress have so many resources to preserve, whether digitized for access or not. We must provide stewardship for more than 132 million items. These include more than 58 million manuscripts, 30 million books, 13 million prints, 5 million maps, 5 million pieces of music, 3 million sound recordings, and 1 million films and videos. And the scary part is that these collections grow by 13,000 items a day. And now we have the opportunity to make much of this material accessible far beyond the walls of our buildings here in Washington. How are we going to take advantage of this opportunity while also ensuring that preservation is carried out on all of these things? I will answer with a kind of story that began a decade and a half ago. How exciting it was back in 1990 when the Library of Congress launched a pilot project to experiment with this new thing called digitization. For the next 4 years, we identified audiences for digital collections, established technical procedures, wrestled with intellectual property issues, and explored distribution options such as CD-ROMs. Indeed, we sent CD-ROMs containing some of our materials to 44 schools and libraries across the country. We received enthusiastic responses, but the format proved inefficient and quite expensive. And then came the internet. In October 1994, with $13 million from private donors, we announced the National Digital Library Program. The program's flagship was the American Memory Historical Collection that we had begun digitizing in the pilot project, consisting of historical documents in multiple media. The web became the means of making these materials efficiently and affordably accessible. Private contributions for the program soon tripled, and additionally, the Congress appropriated another $15 million over 5 years. In 1996, we expanded the partnership element of the program. A $2 million grant from the Ameritech Corporation enabled us to open a 3-year competition to non-federal cultural institutions, museums, archives, and historical societies of all kinds of libraries, which submitted digitization projects in American history that could complement our American Memory Collection. We selected 23 prize-winning digital collections for the American Memory website. By the year 2000, we had exceeded our goal of 5 million items on the website, which today offers a little over 10 million items in more than 100 thematic collections. Included are digital copies of books, manuscripts, pamphlets, prints, photographs, maps, sheet music, sound recordings, and motion pictures. Each collection appears with a set of explanatory features, and the entire assemblage can be electronically searched. This seemed wonderful. Many of you were also building digital collections for access online in the 1990s. But in the same period, all of us realized that we did not know how long we could preserve these resources we were creating. Digital media lacked anything like the durability of paper, and digital documents depended for readability on computer systems that quickly became obsolete. Excuse me. Also, digital preservation would have to encompass multiple and evolving kinds of formats. Certainly, we did not digitize with the intent of replacing original materials, but we wanted to preserve, besides the originals, the digital copies in which we were making such substantial investments. Thus, our gains in access brought new challenges in preservation. The challenges compounded when we started accepting materials created digitally, such as selections of websites that we and the Internet Archive are trying to preserve. Toward the end of the 20th century, drawing on expertise outside as well as within the library, we identified 5 strategic methods for digital preservation. One was essentially a call to vendors to develop a better digital storage medium. The second was that we called refreshing digital data, which basically meant copying streams of digital bits from one location to another. Third was what we called migration, meaning the transfer of digital materials from one format to a newer and hopefully enhanced format. Fourth was technical emulation, the attempt to use technology as if it were the technology on which digital material had originally been generated. And fifth was a desperation option that we called digital archaeology, in which we would be compelled to try to reconstruct the meaning of otherwise unreadable stored bits. Of course, we also paid attention to storage conditions, data replication and validation, and other measures for basic security. Thank you. Waiting until digital material had deteriorated to make a fix would leave us only with the digital archaeology option. Instead, digital preservation required ongoing management of data from the point of creation. We hope to make choices early that would retain necessary metadata for preservation, delay the need for migration, and avoid having to resort to emulation or archaeology. And we hope to create a comprehensive system for long-term storage and management of multiple kinds of digital materials and metadata for their ongoing use. With these hopes, as the new century began, we did three things for preservation. One, we continued our experimentation. Two, we began planning to construct a National Audiovisual Conservation Center, designed to include a repository for audiovisual resources in digital form. And three, we crossed our fingers and prayed that solutions to the digital preservation challenges would emerge. A preservation expert on our staff put a more confident face on the latter in the following conclusion to an excellent report in 2000 on the status of our digital preservation program. Technology advances, she wrote, while sure to present new challenges, will also provide new solutions for preserving digital content. We were not so confident of that, however, as to wait around for it to happen. In fact, we recognized that it would not happen without a major effort, an effort larger than the Library of Congress could undertake alone. In 2001, we joined others in persuading the Congress to appropriate nearly $100 million for a national program, the heart of which was to ensure the long-term storage, preservation, and authenticity of digital collections. This became the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program, or NDIP, in the development of which many of you have participated. You heard a report on NDIP yesterday from my colleague Laura Campbell, and you know that we don't have as much money in this program as we started with, and we're very unhappy about that. At the time I wrote this speech, the money was there, so things can happen very quickly. But even with that unhappy circumstance, we have made enormous progress in this program. Working with the National Science Foundation, NDIP has made numerous grants for projects to improve digital preservation. These include several projects that focus on preserving non-textual resources. For example, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is using an NDIP grant to develop a framework for preserving digital video collections. The San Diego Computer Center at the University of California, San Diego, is using an NDIP grant to work on a preservation lifecycle management process for video material. In addition, NDIP is helping SCOLA, a nonprofit educational corporation that receives and transmits television programming of long-term research value around the world, to archive high-interest portions of that programming in many different languages. We at the Library of Congress join many of you in anticipating benefits from these and numerous other NDIP-assisted projects. At the same time, other preservation efforts have continued in your institutions and in mine, often encouraged by national programs. In 1992, the Congress passed a National Film Preservation Act, which financed a fact-finding study by the Librarian of Congress. The study, which was entitled Film Preservation 1993, reported that only half of the films made before 1950 survive. Only 25% of feature films made in the 1920s, and only 10% of those made in the decade beginning in 1910. The study also found that even the surviving films suffered from such problems as color fading, film-based decay, soundtrack deterioration, and fire-prone film stock. Out of the study came an action plan entitled Redefining Film Preservation, on which the Library of Congress worked with the National Film Preservation Board, drawing on consultations with archivists, educators, filmmakers, and film industry executives. The plan, released in 1994, called on all concerned to take these actions. Make wider use of low temperature, low humidity storage to retard film deterioration and to buy time for restoration projects. Increase the availability of films for education and public exhibition. Develop a public-private partnership to share preservation information. Restore important films and search foreign archives for lost American films. And create a foundation to raise money to preserve newsreels, documentaries, independent and avant-garde films, and socially significant amateur footage. Similarly, we have been partnering with others to focus on needs for preserving recorded sound media. 8 years after the Film Preservation Act, the Congress passed the National Recording Preservation Act of 2000. It called for the establishing of a national recording registry in the Library of Congress to preserve significant sound recordings, for organizing a National Recording Preservation Board to study current preservation practices and needs, and for developing a plan for a national audio preservation program. Participants in this planning effort have declared that audio preservation today is not simply a matter of collecting and storing or transferring endangered records to the digital domain. To achieve the objectives of long-term preservation requires a commitment to long-term processes, which may have, as one preservationist put it, no discernible end. In preparing this plan, we have held public hearings and otherwise solicited comments from representatives of sound recording archives, recording companies, audio engineers, interested scholarly organizations, specialists in intellectual property law, and individuals with collections of recorded sound. The study has coincided with our work to build a new National Audiovisual Conservation Center to be completed this year. I was just there on Wednesday, and it is truly spectacular. It is coming along very well. This is an architect's rendering. I wish you could see the real thing. As we prepare to move to the new center, our Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division, in collaboration with our American Folklife Center, has been working since 1999 to develop approaches to digital reformatting of moving image and recorded sound collections. Among other things, we have explored means of scanning motion picture film, of transferring video recordings from tape to digital files, and of developing digital object packaging. So what is this National Audiovisual Conservation Center? It's a complex of four structures covering 45 acres not far from Culpeper, Virginia, which is about 60 miles south of Washington. The complex will cover 415,000 square feet, built back into the west face of a mountain called Mount Pony. And so much of the complex is covered with earth, grass, and trees that it looks very much like a park rather than a big government building. This month, we are scheduled to accept the complex officially. That is, the Packard Humanities Institute will transfer it to the architect of the Capitol, who oversees the operations of all of our buildings. David Woodley Packard has made this gift to the Library of Congress. When he is finished, it will be something over $150 million that he has spent. In addition, the Congress has provided an additional $52 million for buying shelving and equipment, for relocating collections and staff, and hiring new staff. The complex will house all collections and facilities of our Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division, and provide space that we anticipate will for staff that will grow to about 150 people. A collections building will store our audiovisual collections, except for those on nitrate film. They will go into 122 specially designed separate vaults. The third structure is a central plant for electrical controls, heating, and air conditioning for the entire complex. And the fourth structure will be a three-tiered conservation building. It will house administrative, curatorial, and processing staffs, a beautiful theater, and two leading-edge laboratories for the analog and digital preservation of film, video, and sound recordings. Because the collections building is underground, it will enable us to provide energy-efficient, low-temperature, low-humidity storage, ideal for audiovisual collections. The building will also contain large-scale, multiple vaults with high-density, compact shelving specifically designed to accommodate all of our media formats. The 175,000 square feet of the conservation building will have the state-of-the-art audio listening facilities to use for public programs and exhibits. Also, this building will have naturally lighted workspaces and a 200-seat theater with an organ console to provide music that used to be heard with silent movies. The complex will enable the library to consolidate collections that are now stored in three Washington buildings and five others in Maryland, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Audiovisual reference services will remain in the recorded sound and moving image reading rooms in Washington. Sound and videotape collections will be accessed there electronically, and film collections will be transported, at least at the outset, from Culpeper to Washington on a regular schedule. Audiovisual materials constitute an increasing portion of today's historical record. We expect the new complex to be able to accommodate additions to our audiovisual collections for at least the next 25 years. This includes materials digitally created. A major component of the new AV Center is a digital acquisitions and preservation system. This is particularly significant as part of our obligations for stewardship. Gregory Luco, chief of the MBRS division, has explained it in this way. Excuse me. The center will implement digital preservation as a replacement for reformatting onto increasingly obsolete analog formats. The charge will be evolutionary, will be evolutionary and sequenced. We have already made the transition to file-based digital preservation of sound. At the time of the opening, we will be making the same transition for the preservation of videotape, film, because of its vastly greater image resolution and the amount of digital storage it requires, is much more challenging to digitize and manage in a digital environment. Large-scale digital film preservation will occur at the center once the technology matures and the costs come down. Well, that's our hope and that's our dream as we move into this new facility. Our plans include developing ways to share with you and others the tools, the standards, and innovations that we expect to develop there. The new center will include facilities in which scholars, visiting archival professionals, and students from graduate courses in moving image and recorded sound archiving can meet to consider curatorial and technical challenges and examine improvements in audiovisual preservation and access. For example, we will have an experimental image workstation in the new center, where we expect to use newly developed technology that will speed the digitization and preservation of 78 RPM shellac and acetate recordings. The technology developed at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory has been given the acronym IRENE, which stands for Image, Reconstruct, Erase Noise, etc. IRENE is essentially a form of restoration software. It will enable us to create high-resolution digital maps of the groove surfaces of deteriorated recordings. From these images, technicians can remove debris and extraneous sounds and repair damaged portions. The laboratory, with a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, has created the image machine, demonstrated that it works, and has begun preparing software for its use that can be mastered by library technicians with just basic training. Though we are very excited right now to be getting into our new audiovisual preservation center, we are also excited about preservation projects that we have underway. For example, in 2005, we entered into a partnership with the National Endowment for the Humanities to provide digital access to preserved newspapers of historical value. Since 1982, the endowment has spent $54 million to preserve more than 70 million pages of newsprint on microfilm. These grants have gone to repositories in every state and three territories of the United States for microfilming and establishing bibliographic control of their holdings of newspapers published from the 18th century to the present. The endowment expects to conclude the microfilming project this year. The Library of Congress has provided technical assistance for this project since its beginning. Now, the endowment and the Library of Congress are working in partnership to make historically significant newspapers accessible electronically. This is another example of how rapid change is. When I wrote this paper, this project was called the National Digital Newspaper Program. Today, it will be announced that it is Chronicling America. And in this Chronicling America project, we will digitize historically significant newspapers published in all of the states and U.S. territories between 1836 and 1922. These will be available in a searchable database maintained by the Library of Congress and made freely accessible via the internet. We expect to carry out the project over the next two decades. We have begun by providing support for six state projects that will digitize 100,000 pages from selected newspapers published in California, Florida, Kentucky, New York, Utah, and Virginia between 1900 and 1910. This experimental beginning will enable us to evaluate technical guidelines, selection criteria, and the effectiveness of the program for enabling users to browse and search newspaper pages. Assuming the continuation of funding, we will then expand the program to make grants in every state and territory, in which one organization will coordinate newspaper digitizing by several partners. If this project is successful, Long-term preservation will be assured by the microfilm copies, while access will be enhanced by the digital copies. Another project that excites us is one we just announced at the end of January. It is called Digitizing American Imprints at the Library of Congress. The Alfred P. Sloan Foundation has given us $2 million to begin digitizing thousands of books from our general collections for internet access. We are particularly concerned about brittle books that are in the collections that we are in danger of losing. We intend this to be a demonstration project that can help all of us improve our ability to scan safely many of the works that are in our collections that are physically vulnerable. In addition to the scanning of brittle materials, the project's participants will work on developing technology for displaying and turning pages, displaying foldouts, and capturing tables of contents and indices. In addition to brittle books from across our collections, we will also digitize works in the public domain from these categories of materials: American history books, genealogies, regimental histories, and other material from the U.S. Civil War collections, 6 collections of rare books, works in photography, biographies of photographers, and works on technical aspects of photography. Our digitization project will use the scanning technology called Scribe from the Open Content Alliance. We are now hiring staff and otherwise preparing for the scanning, which we expect to start in a few months. As indicated in my description of the Sloan Program, we have established formal selection criteria for deciding what to reformat digitally. Well, let me try to summarize what those criteria are very quickly. First, we consider the value of the material. Are these materials of national interest? And if so, can digitization make them more readily accessible while reducing the wear and tear on the originals? Next, we consider the condition of the materials. Are digital copies needed because the originals are unserviceable? That is, because they are damaged or fragile or are on unstable media. Next, we consider the use of the materials. Are they often in demand, and do they have high retrieval costs so that making digital copies would be less expensive? And next, we look at the materials' characteristics. Do their physical formats lend themselves to digitization in an acceptably high level of reproduction? Are they in formats which reformatting possibilities are in need of testing? Of course, we also give digitizing priority to access aids, that is, guides, indices, and databases that help users identify and locate other material. In the Sloan Project, as in so many others, we want not only to preserve the original copies, but also to ensure that digital copies will be available electronically for a long time. Consequently, led by our Preservation Directorate and our Information Technology Service Unit, we are working throughout the Library of Congress on policies for life cycle management of digital data. That is, we are working with contractors to extend the longevity of media on which digital data are stored. We are working to improve environmental conditions for digital media. We are working on software and hardware requirements for extending longevity and usability of digital data. We are also working on methods and schedules for checking and maintaining the integrity of digital files. Finally, we are also working on a new strategic plan, which will cover the fiscal years 2008 through 2013 for library services at the Library of Congress. This plan will give major attention to digitization for access and preservation. This plan is a work in progress, but here are some of the things that the current draft stresses. We need to better understand what is being created digitally and increase our contact with those creating those works. Our skills at collecting traditional works need to expand to the digital world. We need to identify digital resources as they are created and apply our collection specialist knowledge to determine which items should be collected. We also know that in the long term, we have to develop trusted repositories for digital items that will be held in the library's collections. What I think our experience means and what I think our plan reflects is this. Like most of you, we will continue to digitize as much material as we can to take advantage of the electronic media for making our resources available worldwide. We simply must do so to enable people who seldom, if ever, visit our physical museums and libraries to use and enjoy, nonetheless, the resources that they contain. Given the technological ability we now have to extend the reach of our museums and libraries, I feel that doing this is at least close to a moral imperative. Additionally, we will take advantage of the obvious ability of digitization to help us meet preservation needs. That is, we will recognize that providing access to digital copies enables us to reduce use of and thus preserve longer our fragile materials. In that sense, digitization and preservation can go together. But also, our plan will recognize that we still do not know how long we can fully preserve the material we are digitizing or material digitally created that we are collecting. Both kinds of digital materials are increasing daily, and their preservation needs grow accordingly. The current wisdom seems to be that no silver bullet or universal solution for digital preservation will emerge, but that progress can be made involving different techniques for different digital formats. That is why it remains so important to continue to work together, as we are doing in the National NDIP program, to improve our means of extending the useful life of digital materials. That is also why it is important for all of us to share with others any progress in digital preservation that we make within our individual programs. To return to that early librarian I described at the start of my speech, I encourage all of us not to sit alone in our institutions, huddled in blankets against the chills of change, warming our feet on the soapstones of tradition. We now have the technological ability to operate far beyond our walls. Let us also cross over our walls to help each other do this. It is so important that we succeed. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Deanna. We have time for a few questions. Anyone? Priscilla?
Thank you very much. That was really very interesting, and I love that new building. It's gorgeous. You made it very clear that digitization for preservation, that is the creation of digital surrogates, to help preserve the, to reduce the use of the originals and to help preserve the original materials, and digital preservation, that is the actual long-term preservation of the digital materials, are two quite different things. In many countries, the national libraries have taken the lead in developing digital preservation repositories for maybe not all the materials that they collect, but at least large subsets of them, the KB in the Netherlands, the British Library, Germany, Denmark, Australia, New Zealand, et cetera, et cetera. And I wondered if you could speak something about the Library of Congress's plans to develop their own digital preservation repository for their own for the long-term preservation of their own digital materials.
Thank you, Priscilla. One of the reasons that we continue to stress the preservation of original materials is that we believe it's very important to keep the artifacts as they were created by the creators. And we think that's a really important national responsibility. So we do that. There is, I'm sure many of you know, there is a plan at the Library of Congress to develop format-specific digital repositories. We have repositories being created at Culpeper for audiovisual formats. The newspaper repository has been created. I am pushing very hard for a much more comprehensive approach to digital repositories in the Library of Congress with our ITS, information technology staff, because I believe we can't collect the kinds of digital materials that we need to be collecting if we don't have those repositories in place. Funding has been the primary obstacle, as you might guess, but it is something we are keenly aware of and pushing for very hard.
Other questions?
Hi, Kathy Larson, University of Arizona Artificial Intelligence Lab. We heard you talk a lot about the planning and the inputs that go into making Library of Congress decisions about preservation and access. Can you talk a little bit about post-project evaluation? How do you know that you made the right selection decisions? How do you know that the websites you provide are being used by people, that they're providing the kind of access you want people to have?
Thank you, Kathy, for an excellent question. We have just completed the first nationwide user survey for the Library of Congress that has been conducted in a very long time. And if I had more time to show you all of the strategic plan for library services, you would see that the feature of that strategic plan that is a little different is that there are performance measures attached to every goal. We are going to be looking at what we want to do, how we're going to do it, and we will specify the measures by which we will evaluate our progress. And as soon as that plan is in final form, that will go onto the web, and all of you will be able to look at that, those performance measures as we proceed toward the goals. This is introducing some new elements to the culture, and it will take a little time to get these performance measures in place, but I think it's very important that we spend much more time thinking about what our users expect of us, what they need, how they are reacting to what we offer. It has taken maybe more time than it should for the Library of Congress to think of itself as an institution with users. It has been the library of last resort for a long time. And as we move out of that environment into a more collaborative environment in which we are part of the information network of this country, requires us to make significant changes in the way we operate, in the way we describe what we're doing to others,
in the way in which we partner with others. And I sometimes think it's going to take too long to do this, but other days I feel really quite heartened that we are making some progress as we try to move from thinking about the National Library and its omnipotence to the National Library responding to national needs.
Okay, one more question. Martha?
Martha Baca, Getty Research Institute. I'm going to bring up a topic that we could talk about for hours, so I know you'll have to give a brief response to it. It's something you talk about often, cataloging. And in my own institution, I'm having to struggle against the misapprehension that full digitization of materials, full text digitization, provides good access. So what are some of the ways that we can sort of combat this frankly idiotic idea that if you scan everything, you have good access to it? You know, there is no metadata without some human labor. So what advice can you give us on this?
I should probably, you know, I just need to stand up for this question because I thought I would come to one conference without talking about cataloging, but no. I agree with you that we have, as librarians, we have so much to offer in terms of describing information, making it findable for people. We have been at this for many, many years, and we actually know how to do it. What I think our challenge is, this is what I say often to my own bibliographic access staff. It is not enough for us to create the perfect finding system. We know from all of the user studies that individuals who are looking for information very often go directly to the open web. And our marvelous catalogs are simply not getting the use that we know they should have. What we have to do, I believe, is find ways to take our content and the metadata for that content and move that content to the open web. And until we do that, I believe we face a high probability of spending much, much, much money on developing bibliographic structures that are used by only a small group of people. So I don't, as you probably know, I have established a working group on the future of bibliographic control to try to help us address some of these questions. I know that in any organization, when people are really good at what they do and they have perfected their techniques and they are the experts, it is very hard to abandon those systems that they've developed. I understand that completely. But it is not enough to say, well, users should use our catalog. I don't know how to make them use our catalog. So I'm a very pragmatic person. I think, well, let's figure out how users are finding what they, finding what they need, and let's go to where the users are. Because what we've wanted to do, since I began in this profession in 1969, we have talked as librarians about how we want to get information into the hands of people who need it. We now have the mechanism for doing that. And my question is, why are we making that hard? Why? We have the opportunity now to do what we've said all along. So let's do that.
I agree that And the technology obviously is in place now to expose that high quality metadata on the visible web instead of having it locked inside of OPACs. And there are less user unfriendly and forbidding ways to expose that good metadata. But I do think we have to seek this balance between the idea that just scanning everything and making it available on the open web provides good access to it. You have to have good metadata associated with it.
And that can
be created by intelligent human beings in a more economical way than we have been doing it to date, hopefully.
Yep, I agree. And I think we need to keep looking for ways to do that. Libraries and other cultural institutions have brought traditionally a kind of judgment to materials that is very valuable. And I'm not advocating that we throw away that judgment. We need to find the best ways to continue to deliver high-quality, relevant content to people who need it. We have lots of ways of doing that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Time for a break. I apologize. This is the first time we've run over. It's because of cataloging. No, it's not because of cataloging. Time for a break. Thank you, Deanna.